This is Joe Basso with Music Radar, and I'm speaking with Black Francis from the Pixies. How you doing?
I'm in the dark.
You're in the dark? Why are you in the dark?
I'm in a dark bunk.
Oh, I see. I thought you were being metaphorical.
Tour bus. Well, no, I can tap into my id here.
Okay.
Give you what you want.
Although I did say the Pixies. Was that wrong? Is it still just Pixies?
I don't think that the Pixies or Pixies really know one way or the other. I think that was a distinction that someone at our record company was more concerned about than we were.
Okay. So these shows that you guys are doing now seem to be going over pretty well. That Isle of Wight festival you did was pretty darn amazing. That crowd gave you, what, a five-minute ovation?
You know, I don't know. I didn't time it, but, you know, I had the sense that they were, receptive to the show, so it was a good thing, yeah.
How does it feel to you? How does it feel that the band is playing these days? It does seem like you're having a blast.
I was going to say, we're laughing all the way to the bank, but that sounds kind of crass. I think what I'm trying to say is we had a good, successful run from our inception in 1986 or whatever till about 1991 or 2 or whenever it was, we sort of stopped making records and performing and, you know, broke up. That would have been more than a lot of people get, you know, but at the moment, you know, we haven't released any new material, really, and people all these years later still want to hear us play our repertoire, and the promoters or the people or whoever, the sponsors, whoever it is that's working it out, mm-hmm. are ensuring that our fees are much larger than we ever received the first time around. And so I think that we just feel very fortunate, not just in a monetary way, but it isn't just the money, it's the fact that you're being paid the money, if that makes any sense.
That someone is willing to pay you the money.
Yes, yes, I guess that's what I'm trying to say. It's not just what you get, it's the willingness with which it was given.
Well, it probably has something to do with that repertoire, but jumping ahead, what are the plans for some new material? Now, from what you've said in past interviews, you guys have been struggling with recording new material. Where is that right now?
It isn't really anywhere that interesting. And so there's not really anything to report in that department, I am afraid to tell you.
But you guys are not saying no to more recording. You're just...
I'm not saying nothing.
Okay.
I've learned to shut up and not say too much.
No, no, you can't shut up here. We need to talk about this.
We can talk about lots, but in terms of any kind of new Pixies records or whatever, I'm literally in the dark.
Okay.
I'm literally in the dark.
But now, you guys did do one song a few years ago.
Right.
Bam Thwack, which was enjoyable. It sounded so effortless. Were there any more recordings from that session?
There was one, and I believe it actually, Kim recently has done some work on it, and I have to go download it off my laptop to listen to it. I've been kind of in a whirlwind the last couple of weeks, so I haven't had a chance to check it out, but yeah, it was all ostensibly for submission to a film, which shall remain unnamed. I can't make too big a deal out of it. I mean, you know, I'm not John Lennon, and I don't play in the Beatles. And so, you know, just because we do one little hiccup, it doesn't mean, like, you know, we need to hold a press conference.
But we do want to hear more, so that's why I'm asking.
Yeah, but I think what you want is not just more. You want a vital, active Pixies. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And there's a difference between that and... we're active, but we're active just sort of insofar as our old repertoire is concerned. So we're not active in terms of anything new. It's kind of like if it starts to get too... It starts to feel all a little bit like Precious or something. You know what I mean? Like when we played our first reunion gig, you know, people hanging out in the alley outside the club to listen to what songs we were rehearsing.
Yeah.
And then, like, texting their friends who were at the computer who were, like, posting it on a message board. It started to feel a little bit like, come on, you guys, come on. you know, come on, you know, well, I don't know. I just, it starts to feel kind of embarrassing or something, or squirmy.
Well, you are one of those bands that does have an incredible legacy and have, of course, influenced many people. People like Kurt Cobain, Tom York, Rivers Cuomo. Even I was talking to Danny Harrison recently, who cited you as a major influence. And one of the things, of course, that is an influence on a lot of these artists is, and you made a film about it, your dynamics. The loud, quiet, loud dynamics of the Pixies. Where did that come from?
I don't know. Much ado has been made about that, and I don't want to say it's much ado about nothing, but we did incorporate some space into some of the arrangements, and that space was marked by a very abrupt filling of the space, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we have the so-called loud, quiet, loud kind of dynamic. But I think those kinds of dynamics are pretty basic. I think it's just because the way that the Pixies did it in sort of an abrupt sort of way was perhaps sounded a little bit peculiar or whatever to certain people at the time. But I would say that the presentation of that dynamic was probably enhanced for a couple of different reasons. And one of them is that we were not sophisticated musicians. We were also honest musicians. So we were never trying to attempt to hide whatever it was we were doing. So rather than a lot of kind of like unnecessary musical posturing to kind of alert the audience that, okay, now we're going to transition everybody. Here we go. We're transitioning. Can you feel it? Oh, wow. Now we're loud again.
Right.
You see what I'm saying? That kind of where you tip the audience off. I think we were just much more inclined to go, well, we're quiet now, so now let's be loud. You know, it was just sort of it's a personality kind of a thing. One of the other things I think that might be worth mentioning is that this was the 1980s, and so I think a lot of the cooler commercial music at that time, not the poor commercial music, but some of the better commercial music, was probably, you could probably categorize it as probably kind of English, or at least English-influenced, kind of gothy, as we would say,
mm-hmm.
or gothic,
mm-hmm.
you know, like a band like The Cure, or a band like the Sisters of Mercy, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Or, what's that band called with Ian Astbury there?
The Cult.
The Cult, thank you. You know, where there's this kind of hard, almost kind of very guitar-oriented, but kind of hard, cold, disco kind of a vibe that you heard in a lot of those records, where the bass was da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, real hard on the eighth kind of a feel. Da-da-da-da-da-da, and the kick and the snare, or the kick, the drum set was reduced or simplified to be very boom, pop, boom, pop, boom, pop, like that. Really stark, right?
Exactly.
So there were some stark flavors in the air, and I don't think that we were consciously trying to emulate that. I think it was just in the air, and we just sort of naturally kind of incorporated a lot of that into what we were doing. Because that's what, you know, when we were rehearsing in David Lovering's Trans Garage or at a rehearsal space that we were renting or whatever in Boston, that might have been what we were doing on a particular night or a particular afternoon. But other times when we were just socializing and hanging out and having a drink or whatever, we were hanging out in nightclubs, in dance clubs, where this kind of music was being played constantly.
Right,
you know? And I think that we absorbed a lot of that.
Would you agree, however, that, say, take a band like U2, where you have The Edge, who would say he's not a guitar virtuoso, but he used his musical limitations totally to his advantage and wound up creating this whole new guitar sound?
Right. I mean, the Pixies are very much about that, and that could certainly be said about Joey Santiago. Again, is much like The Edge, totally used his limitations to create a identifiable sound. And I hate to even think about it in terms of limitations. I think it is.
No,
I mean, I think even with Joey Santiago, I think he probably understood guitar technique and what other, and he understood guitar prowess. But I think that the fact that he wasn't drawn to, say, trying to become that or to practice all day in his bedroom going, it's also an aesthetic. It's just sort of like, you know what, I don't want to do that.
Right.
I just want to do something else that's a different kind of a mantra, a different kind of a thing. A lot of times we say, musicians refer to themselves and their limitations, I suppose, as a way of kind of being humble. And so I don't want to detract from anyone's humility, but I think that it should be said that I think that there's an aesthetic going on, too.
Absolutely. Speaking of guitars and guitar playing, did the two of you kind of sit down and say, okay, we have to work out two distinct styles, two distinct sounds here?
No, not really. I don't think any of this gets really discussed. We might talk shop a little bit, but I don't think that Joey and I ever discussed shop at length. I think that I'm guessing his personality compared to mine, I would say that Joey probably gave it a lot more thought than I did. And he probably, because the guitar was his voice, and I already had a voice.
Right.
You know, I think that I was probably more concerned with singer guy things as opposed to what I was doing on the guitar. And Joey, I think, because the guitar was everything that he was expressing with, I think he probably did think about it a lot and probably arrived at playing Les Pauls for a variety of reasons. You know what I mean? I ended up at a telly, and it's probably appropriate, but I don't know if I gave it much thought. It's just sort of how it worked out.
When did you start gravitating towards tellies?
When I found a Telecaster for $400.
Okay. It wasn't any particular telly players or anything like that that you were into. It was just
No.
The guitar presented itself. Now, I have not seen you guys live in quite a while, but I've been noticing in some of the footage, the tellies that you're playing, now you used to modify them a little bit. You used to put humbuckers in them. It doesn't look like you're doing that anymore. Is that correct?
Well, I never put humbuckers in them. The $400 model I referred to is a Japanese-made Fender Telecaster from the early 1980s that had humbuckers in them.
Okay.
And I have actually modified those humbuckers out of the guitar at this point. But I tend to play vintage guitars now, and at the moment I'm playing not so much vintage guitars, but I have these Piezo pickups that create a faux acoustic sound. And so that's what I'm playing at the moment, live, so I don't have to keep switching guitars. Even though an acoustic sort of looks romantic hanging on your shoulder, it's kind of a pain in the neck to play with a loud band and have an acoustic guitar. It's always feeding back and everything. And so anyway.
That telly that you're referring to, though, the $400 one, is that one of the ones that was stolen some years ago?
No, fortunately not. I still have all four of those Japanese Telecasters, and they've gone through so many modifications now that you would not even recognize them. And I don't play them very much live. I mostly use them occasionally for studio sessions because I have them set up like vintage guitars now, and I have them set up to sound different, you know, like a baritone guitar or a Nashville tuning guitar or whatever. So okay. They're just kind of, I keep them around mostly for old time's sake.
Now, amp-wise, you go back and forth between Marshalls and Voxes. Are you still doing that?
Yeah, the Pixies traditionally played Marshalls from about 1988 or 9, from when we opened up for Soul Asylum at a little club in Columbia, Missouri. We thought they were cool, and so we proceeded to buy new Marshalls as soon as we got back to Boston. And we never sort of went back. They always kind of worked for us. So even though I prefer the Vox AC30s now, we're playing the old repertoire. So the Marshalls have a certain kind of sound on the stage there. And it's, you know, we're not trying to reinterpret the music at this stage of the game anyway. And we're more about replicating records and replicating certain expectations as opposed to, like, getting all jazz about it.
Is this another way of saying give the people what they want?
No, I think it's actually more about serving the song, serving right. The arrangement, you know, as opposed to trying to pander or whatever, you know.
Right.
There's a factor of self-pleasure, of self-enjoyment in all of this, and we like to play what we like to play. You know, we like to play Gouge Away. We like to play Monkey Gone to Heaven. We like to play Gigantic. We like to play Where Is My Mind. We like to play Nimrod's Son, you know.
sure.
We don't like to play do the manta ray or whatever. You know what I mean? It's just sort of, we don't like to play down to the well because it's lesser or something, or, you know, at least at the moment, you know. It was lesser back then, and it's lesser now. You know what I mean?
What kind of pedals are you using?
I don't really use pedals other than not getting the right distortion from whatever amp it is, whatever Marshall I'm using. Sometimes I will bring that out with some kind of like a... It's the one I prefer, I guess, is an old TC Electronics distortion pedal. Right. It's probably about 20 years old or something like that.
Let's move to something completely different here, and it's your upcoming big box set Minotaur. Cost, what, $395 or something like that?
I believe the retail price for the limited edition is $500.
$500? Oh, my God.
That's what I heard. I don't know. I haven't gone online to see the price tag itself, but that's what I thought it was going to be.
I was quoting the bargain price there. Okay. Wow. Quite a set there. What can you tell me about it?
Well, I actually haven't seen one. I've seen a prototype, and I've seen lots of artwork in another context of what's contained therein, but I actually haven't seen a completed, fully matriculated box set. So I'll tell you, my impression is that it's large, physically large.
Okay.
It has a lot of artwork in it, and it's really about the artwork, I would say, from my point of view anyway. You know, it's all about that guy, Von Oliver, and his association with the photographer Simon Le Bestier, and their association with us.
Right.
And they were the people that represented us visually. And it wasn't by design or anything like that. It's like they worked for the record company, 4AD. They were an Artie label. We didn't really care. Well, we did care. It's just that we had other things to do. We already were a kind of arty, weird, quirky, surreal, kind of oddball thing anyway. You see what I'm saying?
Sure.
So when the record company sent you a sleeve with a guy with an extraordinarily hairy back in this sepia-toned, beautiful photograph, you're sending this to the singer of a band who covers the theme from the Eraserhead movie. You see what I'm saying? So it's kind of a match made in heaven, right? I mean, it's kind of like they send you artwork like that, and we just go like, touche. You know what I mean? And we gave them carte blanche ever since. So when we got back together and they decided they wanted to do a box set, or whenever they've done other releases in the past, compilation, best ofs or whatever, we always gave 4AD, and I guess you could say more directly, we always gave Von Oliver and whoever it was he was working with carte blanche to do whatever he wanted. Now, he always consulted with us and showed us what he was up to, but we have never, I don't recall ever speaking a discouraging word about anything he's ever done, even if it was something I wasn't sure about. You
right,
see what
right.
I'm saying? It seems like he gets interesting results, and we're not really a band that involves itself in having much of a... an image. We come from the 1980s in Boston, indie rock, playing in clubs. You know, I've heard the phrase shoegazers, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if that was the phrase that we were using at the time, and I guess you could say we fit that category. You know, most of the bands that I was listening to and watching on club stages back then in 1985 or 1986... we're not concerned about hair or look or any of that kind of thing. It was not about that. And it was not about saying to the audience, hey, how y'all doing tonight?
Right.
It was way more of a fuck you kind of attitude. More of a, not an aggressive fuck you, but a sort of like, leave me alone. You know what I mean? I'm doing my thing. When I get done playing my set, you get to come up and do your thing. Because you're playing with a lot of other bands that are on the same bill that night, right?
Exactly.
So it's kind of like, that was the whole, to me, that was the whole indie rock thing. It was like, okay, y'all, everyone gets their half hour up there. Do whatever you want. You want to, like, you know, roll around in Jell-O. You want to play music. You want to, like, do poetry, whatever the hell it is. I mean, I remember seeing the Swans. Remember the Swans?
Sure, yeah, yeah.
I mean, they would come up. I mean, I never even really listened to one of their records, but I remember going to see them at the Rathskeller in Boston. You know, they had a very arty kind of a thing going on. It was very kind of heavy and kind of dirgy or whatever. But I remember I saw them once at the Rathskeller. They went on stage, and the singer stood up on his monitor wedge and kind of arched his head out. He got as close to the audience as he could without actually falling off of the stage. He stood there for about 10 or 15 minutes and did not say a thing, and the band didn't play a note. And they just sat there for like 10 minutes to try to create tension, right? And then they finally played, okay? That was perfectly, not only was it perfectly acceptable, I don't think the audience ever batted an eye. And and there was tension created, but they might have been made a little bit uncomfortable, but it wasn't like people were going, oh my God, have you seen what's going on downstairs? The Swans are just standing there, not playing. I mean, these kinds of people were doing all kinds of stuff like this, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so the whole idea of being pandering, though, I mean, that's why to this day I have a really difficult time playing a lot of the rock festivals. I mean, I play them, but, you know, when I see that beach ball being bounced around, it just rubs my little indie rock Bostonian College Dropout feathers the wrong way. You know what I mean? I just go, that's wrong, man. It's like, this is not about the beach balls. This is about something else. And all you people that are, I even stopped a gig once a few years ago. It was in France. It was at a Frank Black gig, and they were bouncing around a shark or something, a big blow-up shark.
Oh, my.
Around this crowd of about 20,000 people. And I finally just stopped. I just stopped the song, and I just said, stop. And I demanded of the audience, I said, get that shark out of my sight. I'm not going to compete with a fucking plastic shark. And someone grabbed the shark, and they, no more shark. So I just don't have a lot of tolerance. You know, it isn't, and I've tried to explain this to other journalists, it's like the Pixies were not at their inception, and this is true of a lot of other bands, I think, at that time. It's not about what we were trying to do. It was not about our vision. It was about what we were trying to block out of our vision. It was about what we were trying not to do. We're trying not to do a lot of the showbiz shenanigans or whatever. You know, the showbiz baloney that had become, by 1985 or 86, had become so extremely trite. The rock and roll, you know what I mean? All the rock and roll moves. And I got nothing against rock and roll moves. I got nothing against showbiz, don't get me wrong. But a lot of that kind of expression had become so trite by that time that it was just completely uninteresting to a lot of people. You know what I mean? And we're just like, you know what? We don't really want anything to do with that. I don't know what we're going to do over here, but we're not going to do that. We don't care about that. And we heard about this whole post-punk thing and indie rock labels and all that. We've heard about it, and that's what we're going to become involved in. Because we don't need to do all this other stuff, and we don't want to do all this stuff because we're not interested in it. We're interested in more arty kind of a thing, you know. And then, you know, it's like you're young, you're college age or whatever. You discover all these cool underground records, and you go, oh, it doesn't have to be all the baloney. it can be a lot more esoteric. And I get nothing against showbiz, but showbiz can become, when it becomes soulless, that's when you kind of just turn your back on it, you know, and people think that, oh, you're difficult, you know, you're aggressive, you're whatever. They think all kinds of things, but what they don't realize is that a lot of people just have a basic rejection of the crap, you know what I mean? They're just sort of like, I'm as bad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. You know what I mean? I'm not going to watch any more TV commercials. I'm not going to just have this stuff shoved down my throat anymore. I'm just tired of it. I just want to, and it's not some big spiritual stance. It's just sort of like it's a cry for quality, for individualism. It's a cry for something that has some soul. You know?
You're the musical Howard Beale.
What's that?
You're the musical Howard Beale.
Who's that?
Howard Beale was the guy in Network who actually said, I'm as mad
as
hell.
Oh, sorry, right, of course, yeah.
Yes.
Excuse me. Yeah.
Well, listen, we are just happy that you're back and that you're doing it again. You know, these shows all across Europe are selling out like crazy. Are you going to play the States anytime soon?
You know, I have heard some people on the telephone talking while I've been in the room, people that are in the organization, so to speak, about that very thing, but I'm not allowed to confirm anything, shall we say. You can go ahead and kind of expect it. I'm sure that, you know, what happens in London generally seems to happen. New York writes, I mean, you know.
Well, I will be there, and I won't bring a beach ball or a shark.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, Black Francis, thank you very much for spending all this time with me. This was great.
Thank you.
This is Joe Basso with Music Radar, and I've been speaking with Black Francis, or Frank Black, of the Pixies. Again, it's been great. Thank you very much.
Take care.
All right, take care. Bye-bye. Now.